the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM, and our guest, William Henry. One of the things we'll be talking with William about, the Harmonic Concordance. What is that, you ask? Well, it has to do a little bit with the lunar eclipse, so stay tuned for that one. This Saturday, we are going to have a lunar eclipse. It is supposed to be one grand one, let me tell you. And it's tied into what will become a three-day event called the Harmonic Concordance. Now, in 1987, we had what was called the Harmonic Convergence. And at that time, on that day, apparently mankind swayed in its critical mass to a direction of more global enlightenment. The harmonic convergence stepped up everyone's vibration to the next level so we could all get some kind of glimpse into our own future, known and unknown. So what will be happening on the harmonic concordance now, that will be on November 8th of this year, lasting through the 11th. It's tied into the moment of the eclipse, which was named, of course, the harmonic concordance by an astrologer by the name of John Mayrahiel, and it is thought to be a time when the masses of people will awaken to their own divine origin. Many people feel that some kind of shared focus and collective intent, which we've been doing for years now, right, can influence the field of consciousness to such a degree that resulting effects will be seen in physical reality. Well, we know that will happen. William Henry is an investigative mythologist, author of many numerous books on ancient mythology and neo-archaeology with a Stargate twist by applying the latest theories in science consciousness to ancient myths of the gates of the illumined gods, including Sumerian, Egyptian, and the Holy Grail gateway myths. He hopes to uncover the secrets of the guarded by such groups as the Illuminati. His latest book, Oracle of the Illuminati, states that we are on the verge of rediscovering the sacred science of creating peace on Earth. I sure hope so, William. We're overdue for it, aren't we?
Yes, sir, George.
How are you?
Wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Thanks for having me back on the program.
Likewise. Hey, are you getting ready now for the harmonic concordance?
I am. I've started getting ready back in the summer. I had a chance to meet John Mayrahiel and his wife Jan, a very delightful couple. Met them up in Michigan at an event sponsored by Mary Hardy, a group that are hardcore into helping to bring this event into fruition. So I started hearing about it then, and now here we are all of a sudden.
What is the difference between what occurred in 87 when the planets aligned with the harmonic convergence and now what is called the harmonic concordance, which has to do something with the lunar eclipse? What's really the major difference here?
Well, they're actually very similar. One of the primary differences is that the 1987 date was one that Jose Arguelles, the Mayan researcher, had actually pulled out of the Mayan calendar as one of the initial dates of the countdown towards the Mayan 2012 prophecies. So the difference is that the harmonic concordance is primarily an astrological prediction. It's a horoscope for Earth on the weekend of November 8th through the 11th, whereas the 1987 convergence date was more of a prophetic type of an event.
How many people do you think in 87 really jumped on board with what was going on at that time?
Well, I think a lot of people, a lot more than we realize, jumped on board, because I recall the convergence very well. And In fact, I was in Detroit at that time, and I remember celebrating it with friends. It was a time I had been studying the myths and metaphysics for about 6 or so years then, so I was very interested in that kind of event, and friends had heard about it and just wanted to kind of get their feet wet in terms of participating in a spiritual celebration of that nature, because it was really the very first kind of an event of that nature since the happenings of the 60s. That people had an opportunity to get together, join hands, join prayers, join meditation, and try and manifest something. And I had a kind of a lower note with it. I do remember watching the news broadcast that day, and the people that seemed to have a, equally as good a time with it were the news broadcasters that said, oh, come on, this is ridiculous. We can't change our world. You know, we're done, whatever. So it was kind of a, you know, that's just one of the memories that I have of the convergence.
Well, let me tell you, as we talk about the concordance for a while tonight and all the many things that you've been working on since we last chatted, you know I'm a strong believer in the collective consciousness, and we've done a number of things now on this program where I am now so convinced that it works, it's beginning to become baffling why it isn't to me. Another case in point, William, just a few days ago during the wildfires here in Southern California, we haven't had rain out here in a long, long time, many months. So all of a sudden, you know, people put their collective minds together. I was getting a number of emails, hundreds of fast blasts saying, let's do it together. Come on. And I held back and I said, all right, let's do it. And sure enough, within a day, we started getting raindrops, trickles. People were emailing me saying, I can't believe it. You people just talked about it an hour ago and we've got raindrops now. And by Halloween Friday, we had some heavy rain. And, you know, I'm not going to let the Coast listeners take full credit for the fact that the rain has put out those fires, because the thousands of firefighters are the ones that got that job done. But it is, to me, it continues to be very, very strange how when we do things like this, all of a sudden, with no rain for a long, long time, it begins to roll into the forecast. All of a sudden it rains, stays wet for a couple days, and the fires die down, and now things are going to start to get back to normal again, with the hopes, of course, of the poor people who lost their homes and the 22 deaths that we had. But it just boggles my mind that it seems to work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the power of mass collective focusing is proven over and over again. And as you suggest, it can bring enormous potential to a moment. But in that case, too, it brought a tremendous sense of peace, too, because it suggested that we were getting a break in the fires. It created that environment. It was, in fact, they described it that when that rain and that mist came in, that was the perfect environment for the firemen to fight the fire.
Well, how is it that the mind, collectively or otherwise, can do something and affect something physical?
Well, it all goes back to this notion that there is a single collective consciousness of which we're all participants in. We're all, by our neural networks, hardwired into this net, so to speak. And what we're doing consciously and through our subconscious thoughts as well is something akin to what we do every day on the internet when we fire up our computers and dial up our server and we connect with the net. We're connecting with millions and perhaps even billions of other computers at the same time, and this is an analog, if you will. It's a copy of a natural process that each of us are able to participate in through our own thought.
Now, in this particular case, the harmonic concordance, if people want to participate in it, what are they supposed to do, if anything?
Well, there's nothing that you're really supposed to do. It's thought to be a moment apart, a time when you can begin to focus your intention primarily on your hopes and dreams for the future, both personally as well as for the entire civilization as a whole. I've received calls from a lot of people that are going to sacred sites, oracle centers to pray, to meditate, to anchor this energy is a term that's being used repeatedly. People are sensing that they have an opportunity here as these energies accumulate to bring them down from an ethereal realm into our physical realm. And there's just no telling what kind of potential exists within that moment. Each and every person is going to experience it in their own way, but collectively we can all bring this water, this living water, so to speak, down from the collective well and bring it in and begin to cleanse and purify our thought patterns.
Now, one of the things they're saying in an astrological way is that the lunar eclipse may take on a Star of David configuration. Now, I know what the Star of David is, but how can it take on that kind of configuration?
Well, the lunar eclipse itself won't take on the configuration. The Star of David comes from, or rather is defined by, the positions in our sky of six planets: the Sun, the Moon, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, mm-hmm. and the planetoid Charon. And so together it's these six bodies that form what they call a grand sextile, which is an astrological term for a pattern, a six-pointed star.
And that is one of the important parts of this concordance?
Right. When John Murayhel went and was looking into the future through his astrological programs, he stumbled upon this date about 3-4 years ago of November 8th to the 11th, 2003, and saw this stunning image appear on his computer screen. And it was in the image of the six-pointed star. If you've ever seen a horoscope, you note that it looks essentially like a wheel, and it has the constellations rimming the wheel, and then within that are patterns based upon the particular astrological influences of that moment. Well, the pattern that emerged as he peered into his computer that day was very symmetrical, in fact perfectly symmetrical, and formed the six-pointed star, the Star of David.
Interesting. Interested indeed. So what will you do on Saturday yourself? Anything special?
Oh, I'll probably go down to the Tennessee Bicentennial Capitol Mall down here, which is a beautiful prayer and meditation center, and spend an afternoon there doing what I suggest other people will be doing, which is focusing their intention, bringing this energy in any way possible. I always think that we have to back it up with some kind of an action in addition to that, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do yet, but I'll find some way to bring it into a physical reality that way.
William, will we feel differently? I mean, are we going to feel kind of energetic?
Oh, it's absolutely possible that you're going to feel better. You're going to feel a little different, because especially if that's the intention going into it, that depending upon your own personal astrological profile, it could bring dramatic results, because this is a rare moment. It's kind of, astrologically speaking, it's sort of like going to Vegas and seeing nothing but sevens on the slot machine. For whatever reason, we pulled the lever and it's cherry, cherry, cherry on this particular weekend.
But so, in my case, the sevens never come up.
Well, this might be the time here.
Well, when will the, I guess we don't know when a next event, harmonic event, will occur, do we?
No, we don't, but I can rest assured that there are astrologers that are out there that are looking for this. I was wondering if any had looked into the past, because, of course, the Star of David, you're automatically making associations with the Star of the Magi and things of this nature. And, of course, the Star of David itself is a blueprint for wholeness. So it's a dramatic sign that we're moving forward here. I had an astrologer describe it to me. It's as if collectively we're all walking through a hallway. And as a civilization, we go through one door, and then we go through another door, and then we go through another door, and we just keep going through these doors as if we're tunneling through time. And every now and then, very rarely, comes an event as dramatic as this that lets us know the destination, that we're actually going through the door. And it in fact, John Murayhel has described this as an energetic stargate. Now, this doesn't mean we're going to be suddenly transported somewhere, but it does speak to this notion that it's a very clearly defined moment when we know that a door is opening and we're going to be able to step through it.
I'll tell you, William Henry's website is linked up now with coasttocoastam.com. You'll find it right underneath his name under tonight's guest. It's williamhenry.net. And also, William, Dana Augustine has some tremendous artwork that she's created for you about the celebration of the concordance. And it's just great picture that we've captured from you and put on the website here.
Thank you. Yeah, Dana's a terrific artist, wonderful guy. I've really enjoyed working with him these past several years. He has an uncanny ability to, it just time after time, I'll be thinking, this is kind of the kind of image that I would like to have for the book cover or for this masthead, for example. And next thing I know, Dana's already emailed it to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's got the Star of David depicted there. In its fashion. Also, if anybody wants any more information on the Harmonic Concordance, there is a website link also shortly right underneath the picture that you'll see on the website, astrosite.com. Go take a look at that as well. Wanted to take just a few moments, William, to get your reaction to these bursts of solar flares that we've been getting lately. We've been darn lucky that we haven't had any significant damage here on the planet. Had this X-40, which is what they think it might be now, had that had a direct hit on the planet, there's no telling what would have happened.
Yeah, it is just absolutely amazing. I started following the solar flare story back in 96. I had an opportunity when I was in Denver to go over to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and talk with them, and they've been concerned about this increased solar activity since that time, and because we're so exposed with our satellites, with our communications, with our entire culture now is based upon our ability to connect in this way, and if you suddenly take that out, where are we? But even more importantly, there's kind of an interesting spiritual twist to this as well, because prophetically speaking, billions of people are anticipating a second coming of a Christ or Messiah. And the interesting thing about that is that when Jesus was nailed upon the cross, Pontius Pilate had placed a placard that had the inscription INRI placed upon it, I-N-R-I. In traditional Christian terms, this is interpreted as Jesus the Nazarene, King of the Jews. And it was placed there both to state his crime, how dare he proclaim himself the King of the Jews,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and also to mock him. But in the esoteric tradition, INRI is interpreted differently. It's interpreted to mean by fire, frequency or vibration, humanity is renewed whole. And so that's what I went to the folks at NOAA to talk with them about, is there a possibility that the billions of tons of charged particles in those mass coronal ejections, is there any possibility that those can have an impact on humanity in a spiritual sense? And in fact, when we think of those mass charged particles as the fire's frequencies or vibrations that are coming in and bathing the planet, and we begin to look at them from that perspective, something really interesting happens. I mean, what we find is that NASA, going back to 1971, has been studying these charged particles and the manner in which they impact humanity, because when the Apollo astronauts first went into space, they were constantly being bombarded by these charged particles, and as these particles pinged off the retina of the astronauts' eyes, they began to see what they described as phosphenes. Now, these are symbols such as curlicues, grids, tunnels, things such as this, and they were very distracting. And in fact, NASA had to redesign the space helmets in order to deflect those cosmic rays so that the astronauts could go about their work.
Now, were they seeing things that were actually in space, or was this being created in their minds based on the reaction?
Here is the amazing thing about these phosphenes and the connection with the charged particles. At the same time that NASA is doing their investigations into this phenomena in 1971, Tim Leary and his gang up at Harvard mm-hmm. are experimenting with LSD, and they are seeing the exact same symbols. Now, there were some anthropologists from Australia that looked at this phenomena, and they noticed that the very same symbols that the Apollo astronauts were seeing, that Tim Leary's gang was seeing, were the same symbols that were etched on archaic rocks going back as many as 20,000 years in Australia. And what they determined was that this symbol system, these phosphenes, must be literally hardwired into our DNA. They're activated by solar flare activity through the charged particles that ping off the retina of our eye and release these symbols that are latent within us.
You know, last night my guest, Hank Wesselman, confirmed some of the things that you were saying with these pings that were occurring on the eyes of astronauts. It was really remarkable. It must be fun to wake up in the morning and have the kind of job you have.
every morning about 5:30 a.m. Here I am, peering through this little window I have here, trying to bring it all together.
Many, many months ago, when the Iraqi war was underway, we started talking about Stargates.
Mm-hmm.
And as compelling as it was, we chatted about Saddam Hussein. And Saddam Hussein apparently was seen running around the Iraqi countryside with some kind of a necklace with some huge stone in the middle. And there was talk about a Stargate being hidden away in Iraq somewhere, which would have allowed him to escape into God knows where. And still to this day, William, they can't find him. Now, they're saying things like they think he's holed up in Tikrit, his hometown, masterminding some of these events that are occurring there now. But they still haven't found him. Let's talk a little bit about what you think was around his neck and also this possibility of a Stargate being in Iraq, which, of course, as you know, was where the Sumerians started off a long time ago. But what was he wearing, first of all?
Well, he was alleged to be wearing, in fact, he was wearing, but what it was alleged to be was a blue stone. It was similar to a blue stone that he also is said to have had embedded or implanted within his armpit. Now, this sounds like, wow, you know, what are you talking about, a blue stone here? You know, how can that have any kind of a power? I mean, the fact of the matter is that Saddam, and this was reported in the San Jose Mercury News, in fact, you put it up there on the Coast site as well.
Yes, yes.
That he trained or taught the Iraqi people to believe that because he possessed this stone that he was immortal. And I was extremely excited about the revelation of this stone because it fit the overall profile of who Saddam who Saddam compared himself to.
Maybe he did complain too, yeah. Once in a while.
Right. Saddam believed, of course, that he was the reincarnated biblical king Nebuchadnezzar. And it was easy to predict that he would want to possess such a stone because Nebuchadnezzar had sought this stone as well.
And he even named, Saddam even named a military unit after that king, did he not?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And in every way, shape, and form, in terms of rebuilding the libraries of ancient Iraq, in terms of attempting to duplicate the monuments and the temples that Nebuchadnezzar had built in 570 BC, approximately, Saddam was trying to duplicate this figure and, in fact, outdo what Nebuchadnezzar had done. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had sought the secrets of this blue stone, which goes all the way back to the original Sumerian myths of the Anunnaki and Ea or Enki, whom Zechariah Sitchin upholds as the Anunnaki genetic scientist that came to Earth in search of gold, but also in search of the blue stone that causes illumination.
Mm.
And it appears that Saddam was trying to connect himself with the secrets of the Anunnaki and portraying himself as a, well, one of the things that it's alleged to be able to do is to cleanse and purify the blood so that one can live longer.
Merely by wearing it?
Merely by wearing it, but also by imbibing it as well. Perhaps through some form of a homeopathic remedy whereby pieces or portions of the stone
you grind it up or something like that?
Right.
Okay.
Exactly. So there's lots of different things that go along with this blue stone thesis, including the idea that it was blue sapphire as being this blue stone. In fact, it's been claimed that on Moses' first trip up Mount Sinai, that he was given this blue stone of enlightenment, and when he comes back down Sinai and sees the Israelites worshiping the golden calf, and he smashes the tablets, that he's actually saying, you're not worthy of this blue stone at this time. And in place are substituted the two tablets containing the Ten Commandments. So it's quite possible that it is sapphire, but then it's also been claimed that sapphire, as it appears in the Bible, is a mistranslation of the word sapur, which means holy blood. So from this we get this image that the blue stone is actually some form of an agent that cleanses and purifies blood. And then after that is when Saddam had this implanted within his armpit.
That's amazing.
Absolutely amazing. And it connects the dots on so much of the Anunnaki mythology and just affirms that this was a person who was very much like Adolf Hitler, who was attempting to reclaim the glory of his civilization's past, but only to twist and to pervert it. Because assuredly, Saddam wasn't going to share this technology with the common Iraqis. He was going to use this technology to keep himself at the top of the tower, so to speak, as the gatekeeper. And was this, in part, the purpose for our going over there? I mean, mind you, I saw a number the other day by the columnist Jonah Goldberg that he's still wondering, we know it's about more than oil. And what was it that Saddam was hiding that he was willing to forego over $100 billion in oil revenue in order to protect?
And we know now it wasn't weapons of mass destruction.
It definitely was not that. So it points to something else, and we have to go back to the statements and the actions of this figure of who he claimed that he was, a reincarnated biblical king who is here to rebuild the gate of Babylon.
Well, and as we know, William, in his very own country of Iraq, I mean, he had unlimited resources to do his own archaeological digs, excavations. Who knows what he would have come across?
Absolutely.
Had he stumbled into the exact spot where the Sumerians lived in Iraq, southern Iraq, maybe he stumbled into some things that he has now tried to protect and has taken. I just find it very ironic, as you well know, I don't believe in coincidences, mm-hmm. that we can't find the guy. We supposedly had him cornered several times, and he seems to like disappear like an invisible man all the time.
Right. As if he's walking through portals of some kind. One more thing about the Blue Stone that's very important. I'm in my new book, Oracle of the Illuminati. I'm following up on these stories of this divine pearl, the divine essence, the divine spark, or other terms that it's given. And I happened to see John Lear had been talking with Art.
Yes, over the weekend. Yeah.
Over the weekend. And he gave his briefing where he stated essentially that we were created by alien beings.
Mm-hmm.
That these beings are the gray type figures who are basically robotic, and that they are interested in some form or some kind of something that has been deposited within the human body, which they view as a container. I've gone along with that hypothesis for a long time. I don't use the word container. I use the word manufacturing plant. Our bodies are designed to manufacture many different things. But what I'm following up on right now is the early Christian text from the years approximately 50 AD after the time of Jesus up until the year 200. And what these texts describe is the creation of humanity by a figure that we would describe as an alien who had created several hundred helpers that were not imbued with this divine essence, and they were interested in humanity because humans did have this divine essence, this divine spark. It's described as the blue pearl or the blue stone in the Eastern texts.
Now isn't the chemical cobalt much like that too? The mineral cobalt?
Zechariah Sitchin in the 12th Planet hypothesized that that was the blue stone that Ea or Enki was interested in. I think it's something different. Cobalt, of course, is radioactive, and other blue stones that have been proposed are turquoise, lapis lazuli, other stones such as this, but I think it's something different than that. It's something of a more of a spiritual nature, a spiritual essence, and humans contain the blue stone naturally. And this is part of the secret that's been covered up for a long time. And as John Lear mentions, this is the interest that these extraterrestrials quite possibly have in humanity. We have this divine essence. We have the blue stone of immortality already within us. What we need is the means to activate it. And when we activate it, we're able to travel into other dimensions. We're able to exude healing abilities. We become, in effect, gods.
Well, let me tell you something. I wonder if Saddam Hussein handed one of these stones to his buddy Bin Laden because he can't be found either.
Right. quite possible because, again, you know, Afghanistan, like ancient Iraq, is loaded with this kind of mythology. This is the underpinnings of all of the cultures and religions in that area.
A few years ago, William, had I heard a story like this, I would have said, come on. But the more and more that I get into it, and more that I read up on it, the more and more I talk with you about things like this, and the fact, the clear fact, that there are just so many very strange things going on this planet, I'm beginning to say, you know, all of this is entirely possible, where a few years ago I would have said, I'm not so sure. Now I'm beginning to think it's more possible than not.
Absolutely. There's no question we're through the looking glass right now. And we're in the wonderland, and now the object is to come up with a new map, because anything is possible. I mean, physicists themselves don't even have language to describe the world that we live in right now with our recent discoveries. They barely have the mathematics to be able to describe this. So we're clearly in a new realm right here, and there's literally no looking back. And so what it is called for is for each of us to, if this blue stone, this blue essence is within us, this is appears to be the focus where we want to draw our attention, because the more that we become aware of ourselves as these divine beings having a physical experience at this moment, it's going to enable us to more fully understand this moment and also to take advantage of it.
I tell you what, if they ever do capture Saddam and he's got this necklace around him, that's going to be fodder for more stories, huh?
For the next five decades, I'm convinced they'll be churning out books just like they did about Hitler and his use of the occult.
Yeah, I think so too. Look, I want to talk more about stargates. Explain for us, if you would, William, just what we're talking about here when you talk about a stargate possibly being in Iraq.
What we're talking about is likely a literal physical device, a device that opens up gateways or portals into other realms. So that if one were to enter this gateway in, say, the vicinity of Baghdad, one could travel to any place they would like on Earth, or conceivably within our solar system and beyond.
Okay, now where might it be?
My sense, if I had to give you a knee-jerk response, is it's buried underneath that swamp that Saddam drained.
Oh, now, do you think we have troops in that specific spot?
We do, and we're rehabilitating that swamp. It's the home of the Madan people, who are an ancient group that have ties to the original Christian followers of John the Baptist, who called themselves Mandans. After the persecution of the original Christians, many of them fled. Some of them, the Madans, went to southern Iraq. And it's their marshlands that became a place of fixation for Saddam. He drained hundreds of thousands of acres of swampland in an ecological catastrophe akin to us losing the Everglades in Florida. And nobody could understand why he was doing that. Certainly, if he wanted to eliminate the Madan people, he could have done so in a far easier manner. But he was absolutely obsessed with this location and of draining this particular swampland.
Now, this apparatus, which you say is physical,
yes,
it would look technological?
Well, my research has led me to a device that has as its platform what we think of as the biblical Ark of the Covenant.
Aha, uh-huh, okay.
Which Lawrence Gardner and other researchers are now beginning to prove, to use that term, is a device that is capable of generating monoatomic elements of alchemy. Attached to this Ark of the Covenant platform is a pillar called the Shuti Pillar, or the Pillar of Enlightenment. And according to Egyptian myth and legend, this pillar has the ability to drill holes in space.
Drill holes in space.
Yes. It stands between 90 and 180 feet tall, having a telescopic ability. and it was literally passed around the ancient world. It's one of its original sites was in Sumeria, because Ea or Enki, the Sumerian genetic scientist who's connected to the blue stones, was the original owner of this device. And then we find it in a remarkable temple in Lower Egypt called Abydos. At Abydos, you see depictions of this device. You see it in action with the goddess Isis supervising it, where it's called the pillar or symbol of Osiris, the Egyptian savior god.
William, I don't know why, but I seem to be obsessed with this Stargate, only because of the possibilities of what it can do and where you can go. Do you consider it a time machine?
Yes. That's a very good way to characterize it, most certainly. Because a person can enter this Stargate, travel to a distant place within the cosmos, and come back with very little time having expired on Earth. And it is also theoretically possible that it can take us back in time as well. So it's you can definitely characterize it as a time machine.
Now, do you think if we find it, we might be able to reverse engineer it and build something a little more technical with it?
Well, that's the idea here, is that this device that I'm describing, let's just call it a pillar or an antenna, because that's what the ancients called it. They said that the immortals dwelled at the place where this pillar was located because of the energy that emanated from within it. It's also technically a particle accelerator. And physicists tell us that this is the key to stargates and time travel. The thing is that we just don't have the technology right now to develop a particle accelerator of the power that's being described in these stories. I mean, we need a particle accelerator that's millions upon millions of times more powerful than what we're capable of developing right now. But I hold to the idea that, and this is a tip off from Dr. Carl Sagan, who described the civilization. Actually, it was Dr. Kip Thorne, an associate of Sagan, who described the civilization that would be capable of developing this technology as arbitrarily advanced, which means that this is a civilization that's going to think outside of the box of where we're presently thinking and might have a different idea about how to approach this.
Precisely, though, where did it come from?
Where did the technology come from?
Yeah.
Well, if you follow the thesis of Zachariah Sitchin, it came from the Nibiru, that the Anunnaki brought it here with them. And that's quite possible. It may even have just simply come out of divine consciousness itself. The reason I suggest that is because I've found the blueprint for this, or what I consider to be a blueprint for this device, in numerous cultures, Sumerian, Egyptian. I found it in Chinese artwork from the 2nd century A.D. It appears to be something that is within us that we're almost compelled as humans to actually build. And the interesting twist on this is that the blueprints for this device are quite strikingly similar to the energetic or spiritual blueprints of the human body. And my speculation has been is that when Ea or Enki came to Earth and designed the human body as a manufacturing plant, or to use John Lear's term, as a container for the blue stones that enable this kind of interdimensional travel, that he designed the human body based upon the blueprints for this device, as if there's a one-to-one relationship between humanity and the stargates of the gods. And in fact, when we go into the book of Genesis, we find that that's exactly the story, because what happened after the fall of Adam and Eve? The gate to Eden is closed by Yahweh, and a flaming sword is placed in there guarding that gate, with cherubim on either side of the gate. And all of human quest has been a quest to retrieve the secrets of that gate and to re-enter Eden,
mm-hmm.
which likely isn't a patch of ground in southern Iraq, is more likely the billions upon billions of galaxies which inhabit the known universe.
Do you think this Stargate might have been part of the basis for the late Sagan's script, Contact?
Absolutely no doubt in my mind that Dr. Carl Sagan was operating from a blueprint provided to him by other authorities, let's call them Illuminati, behind-the-scenes figures, who gave him the suggestion that you're going to have a blueprint for a device beamed down from Vega with a very interesting Nazi twist to it, and that this device is capable of opening up a hole in space through which a human being, Ellie, in the movie Contact, could be flushed through this transportation system. Now, the interesting thing about it is that Ellie goes in that movie to the center of our Milky Way galaxy, which is exactly where the ancient myths and legends of the gateways suggest one would travel to. And when Ellie gets to that place, the character in the movie who plays her father remarks that we don't know who built this transportation system. It's just always been there.
Exactly. And they gave it to them, I guess.
Right.
Yeah.
And in fact, Paul Davies, writing in Scientific American, said that stargates and wormholes may be a natural after effect of the Big Bang. They have always been there. And the other option is that these stargates or wormholes are created from subatomic matter. And what we need is this particle accelerator technology that will enable us to open the throat or mouth of such a wormhole so that a human could travel through it.
There's no question in my mind, William, that eventually we will be traveling in space that way.
I agree.
I don't know when, but I know we will be.
Yeah, and the thing that Sagan left out of the Contact story was what the ancient myths had said, is that travel by Stargate by a human will probably not take place in the present form that we're living within. That indeed there is a profound mental, spiritual, physical, and emotional transformation that is undergone preparatory to this experience. And we find that that is the teaching of numerous temple medical facilities throughout the ancient world, including Abydos in Egypt and also at the goddess Mary's temple in ancient Syria going back to 2200 B.C.
Well, let's take the approach, as far-fetched as it might seem to many people, that Saddam Hussein had a Stargate, knew where one was, and is gone. Where is he? What? Where did he end up?
Well, given the timing, I would put him in the local neighborhood here and suggest he might have gone to Mars.
You mean in a physical way or in a spiritual way?
Well, it would have to be more than likely in a spiritual way. I'm just not sure that it would be in a physical manner, although it's quite possible, because remember, what we're dealing with here when I'm interpreting, for example, the Sumerian myths and legends presented by Zachariah Sitchin especially, is we're talking about technology and stories that represent what the Anunnaki had several thousand years ago.
You know, the New York Times will have in their paper tomorrow, William Henry, mythologist, says Saddam Hussein on Mars.
Yeah, well,
I'll give you a second chance. You want to stick by that one?
I do want to stick by it. I mean, I would say, well, you want to be conducting your search on Mars. That's where it all leads.
Well, you never know. You never know. On your website, WilliamHenry.net, you have a very fascinating picture of a crop circle. Tell me about that.
Right. This is one of the most interesting crop circles I think I've ever seen of the thousands that have appeared within the past decade. This is one that shows three circles. You have some concentric rings in the center, and then there are two circles on either side of it. And what crop circle experts have maintained is that this glyph, which is called the Chilbolton glyph, and it appeared in August 2000, is quite possibly a glyph or a symbol representing the means by which crop circles may be made. And in fact, they label this the quantum entanglement crop circle, because it's considered to be a representation of what is essentially Stargate, or rather Star Trek beaming technology. On one level, it represents the concept of instant communication of states over a distance at another level.
And it is a very complicated looking crop circle and formation.
Right. And what is so fascinating about this crop circle is that it appeared in August of 2000, right next to the Chilbolton Observatory in England. 1 year later, another incredibly and even more enigmatic and powerful crop circle appeared at the very in the very same field. This crop circle is a dead ringer for the 1974 Arecibo message that Dr. Carl Sagan and Dr. Frank Drake had conspired to send out into space. When the crop circle comes back to Earth, it is slightly modified in some very important ways. And this was a story that was widely reported in August of 2001, just before 9/11, and then conveniently disappeared. Because at the time, in August 2001, this was considered a possibility of first contact, that we had sent out this message in 1974, mm-hmm. and now it comes back in a modified form. And relevant to this crop circle that we're describing, one of the modifications that had been made to this crop circle concerned the method of communication that the alleged beings who created this crop circle used. And the method of communication was this very same crop circle that appeared 1 year earlier and represents the communication at a distance or quantum entanglement concept.
Do you believe there's a specific message behind this one?
Well, I do, because I go along with the crop circle experts that are saying that it encodes the method by which the circles are made. And it gives an idea of the technology of the, let's call them beings, whether they're human or of an alien form, that actually create these glyphs.
See, I just can't see how someone by hand could do this and nobody see them. I mean, that one looks pretty darn complicated, the brownish one.
Right. The bottom one, there's two images there.
Yeah.
The bottom one is not a crop circle.
No, that's a black and white picture of what?
It's a black and white picture from the 18th century from a tantric and Indian document.
That's weird.
That is called Rose Apple Land, and what it signifies is it's a depiction of our universe. Now, what is interesting to me is that I have been mentioning here a particular pillar and that I described as an antenna.
Yeah.
This pillar is called the Pillar of Meru.
Which you believed also was on the Ark of the Covenant, right?
Yes, exactly. Okay. This is a blueprint of the Ark of the Covenant.
And did you, if my memory serves me, did you say that you thought it was no longer on the Ark, wherever the Ark might be now?
Right.
Okay.
Yes. And what this 18th century tantric document represents, as well as what I think the Chilbolton quantum entanglement crop circle represents, is a top-down view of a blueprint for the Meru pillar, the antenna that the Sumerians and the Egyptians said could drill holes in space.
When you uncover stuff like this, this information, what do you do with it? You know, I know you put it in these books. You've got a lot of them out there.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, do scientists get the information, and then what do they do with it?
I confer with as many possible peers as possible. And I have a readership of the Coast audience is absolutely astounding in terms of the knowledge base that is representative by this collective mind that we're all participating in. And so what I do is form it place it in the form of a question. Do you see a resemblance between this 18th century diagram and this 20th century crop circle? Almost 21st century crop circle, actually. And if the answer is yes, then we proceed. How are they similar? Well, they're strikingly similar in their layout and their design. And what does that mean? And so now I go back to the tantric document and say, well, what they say that this represents here is a place called Rose Apple Land that creates a particular energy, an energy of life. And what I find that's so compelling about this is the connection to the Ark of the Covenant that's inherent in this, and that is that the Ark held the manna, the dew, the food of life. And what we find is that in the Hebrew book, the Zohar, they describe the manna as the holy apples. And they describe the manna field as the field of holy apples. this is strikingly similar to what the tantric people are saying this this diagram represents, rose apple land, the land of the holy or spirit apples. And in fact, in the Zohar, they say that those who accumulated the manna received blessings, they received mercy, and they were called the reapers of the holy field, which is an absolute direct link to the crop circles and the fields in which they appear. So my bottom line here in suggesting this is that what we've got here appears to be a lead that we can follow up in terms of a technology by which the crop circles may be made.
You know, what this all points out to is just with regards to mythology and what might be happening on this planet, just how many just incredibly baffling events are ongoing at the same time. I mean, it's sometimes there are too many to count.
Right, absolutely. I mean, and that's why I try to focus and center it on the body, on how can we take this information and these baffling events and apply it to our daily lives so that we enhance our earthly existence, but ultimately can use this information to perpetuate our spiritual growth.
You've been investigating now for how many years, William?
Well, I started researching when I was in college. That goes back to 1982, and then I began lecturing and publishing in 1996.
Okay, of all the things that you have worked on in your career, of all the things, is there one that continues to perplex you the most? One thing?
Well, it would have to be this pillar. In tracing it around, I've now written 10 books that are in and around this device, and I'm sure I can write another 30 and just scratch the surface on this technology.
You know, what I want to do in the remaining portion of this hour when we come back from the break is talk about your new book, Oracle of the Illuminati. When does that come out, by the way?
December 1st.
Okay. And how do you get that?
They can go to my website, williamhenry.net, or call 615-292-7863.
I'll always remember one of the first programs you did is we blew up your server.
And yeah.
And now you're handling them quite well.
Yeah, we got that all fixed up.
You constantly update the website. You got a very nice one there. Your webmaster does a good job with that.
Yes, that's Demi and a revised code. He's a great guy and works very hard for me. I really appreciate it.
The type of research that you do as investigative mythologist, do you ever get involved in the Greek mythology at all?
Well, I do in a surprising way because here in Nashville, where I live, we have a duplicate accurate to an eighth of an inch of the Parthenon from ancient Greece. So I literally have a book in stone right here in my backyard. I can walk to it.
And anything in that kind of mythology that ever surprised you?
Yeah, and that happened this summer. You know, Greek myth is bewildering. Zeus, you've got Athena, you've got Hermes, you've got Hephaestus, all these names, different legends and stories you got to keep track with. You need a scorecard when you're reading these books. Like, who are these people?
I go to a Greek restaurant here every once in a while, and Greek people in here, and that's all they talk about is mythology, and it fascinates them. They don't all believe in what might have come down, mm-hmm. but they do all say one thing that I find very interesting, William, and they all believe that the perception of a certain level of a god, that something indeed might have happened on this planet, and it could have been extraterrestrial.
Well,
they all believe in God,
mm-hmm.
which is a good thing.
Right.
But they believe that something happened on an extraterrestrial way on this planet.
Right, and that was the surprising thing that happened this summer, is when I made the connection that the Greek gods, Zeus and Hephaestus and so forth, they're simply renamed Anunnaki. That's all they are. Zeus is Enlil. Hephaestus is Ea or Enki. It goes on from there. And so once we can make the connection to something we already know, the story unfolds like a book. It's incredible.
Hey, the new book, of course, Oracle of the Illuminati. Tell me the basis of it.
Well, it's part of, I'm writing an Illuminati trilogy. The first book was called The Cloak of the Illuminati. And what happened in Cloak is I was tracing the myths and mysteries of this transmittable cloak that had been passed along throughout the ancient world. People such as Elijah wore this cloak. It was a magic garment that transformed an ordinary human into a figure that we call a prophet or an oracle. So in the Oracle of the Illuminati, what I'm doing is keying on the secrets of these oracular figures. Now, when you look up the word oracle in the dictionary, you find that it means something like a divine announcement, a prophecy, a revelation, an agency or a person who's in communication with a deity. And that word communication is the key word here, because I'm through this book I'm able to pull a lot of pieces together to show the process of here of how they were able to communicate with what we consider to be the God source.
Interesting. Now when I say the word Illuminati, I've always believed it to be that there's this hidden group of power mongers on this planet who are trying to control very, very major aspects of events on this planet.
Right.
Are these the same kinds of people you're talking about when you talk about the Oracle of the Illuminati? Same people?
Yes, we're talking about the same people, but from a slightly different perspective, from the understanding that the secrets that this group possesses are the real prize for humanity. And there are two swords, or two sides, two edges to the sword of the Illuminati. You have the good Illuminati, you have the bad Illuminati. And when we go back throughout history, we find that this has been a continual battle. Earlier I referenced the second century, the early Christian manuscripts that talk about this very issue of a group of so-called bad Illuminati that are attempting to control and manipulate humanity, but into the picture is sent a good group of Illuminati, typically even referenced as the figure we know of as Jesus Christ, because when, again, you go to Webster's Dictionary, you find that the word Illuminati originally meant a newly baptized Christian initiate. And now this doesn't necessarily refer to a baptism in water, as, for example, dunking someone in the River Jordan. What it refers to is a baptism in a body of knowledge or wisdom that is symbolized by water. And so that's the interest that I have, and being very aware that throughout history there are these groups that have attempted to befuddle, to mislead, to seduce humanity, to keep us away from these secrets, but yet, going back again to these early Christian manuscripts, they're saying the focus of our life must be on how to transform ourselves as humans.
This group, though, this Illuminati group, they've been around a long time, haven't they?
From the very beginning.
Is it a family-type group, or they just keep rolling it over and over?
Well, that's the picture one gets when studying the Anunnaki, is that they're all too human in terms of their emotions. They're susceptible to family squabbles, to turf wars. And unfortunately, in their battles and the wars between the gods, humans end up being the swords.
These people, because it fascinates me, one on a conspiratorial way and the other just in the way that they search out power. They got more money than God, don't they?
Well, that's what we're led to believe, certainly. They actually manufacture money. They make it.
Yeah, I know, and I know who we're talking about. So they've got all the money they need in the world. They have their houses. They have their cars. They have everything they need in excess. The one thing they strive for is this omnipotent power, right? They want that power, and they'll do anything they can to get it, won't they?
Well, earthly power, certainly.
Okay, good point. Earthly power. What do they try to do to get beyond earthly power?
Well, that's the question, and that's kind of the kink in the armor here, isn't it? If these secrets are real, as, for example, Isaac Newton is considered one of these illumined ones who was interested in finding the secrets that would enable him to become invisible, in other words, a being of light. I don't see that, you know, the top 10 Illuminati figures on this planet as being necessarily questers of that secret. If a person really knows that this is what it's all about, then they're wasting their time in terms of attempting to accumulate earthly power, because that's not going to get them anywhere. And so what I'm trying to fathom here, to understand, is where did the disconnect come in here? Are they simply being misled by these other entities that are controlling and directing the negative Illuminati on the planet? And I have to say that that's, I think, what the case is.
Are they constantly in this quest to obtain technology from, I guess, beyond technology that might have been left behind by possibly extraterrestrials? Are they obsessed with it?
They're obsessed constantly with it. And in fact, it's expressed throughout history in terms of four elements. If you research the stories of the Illumined Ones, the Shining Ones, the Illuminati of the ancient past, you will often run upon stories where they're attempting to claim the science of earth, air, fire, and water, the four elements. And today, those four elements have been retooled. I call them the four 21st century power tools. They're genes, bits, neurons, and atoms. And with the convergence of those four new technologies, they're all becoming one, we are in a position now to completely redesign the human being. We're literally creating a second skin for humanity based upon our understanding of computer science, of the way the brain works, of our genetics, and also with our nanotechnology. Now, these four elements have always been used to control humanity because essentially they tell us that's what we're composed of.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the right combination of those elements, mediated by the fifth element, the quintessence, the spiritual energy, will transform an ordinary human into a Christ-like being.
Oh, really?
Yes. And right now, we're in the halls of our institutions such as the Pentagon, the halls of MIT, our greatest research institutes in America. This is what they're talking about right now.
Is there anybody else ahead of us in this kind of technology?
Well, yeah, in a sense, because we're so focused on the material aspect of it here in the West that we're losing the race to those in the East that understand that this technology is not going to work unless we have the right consciousness to make it work. And so we're losing the consciousness race right now with researchers in China, with researchers in Russia that have apprehended already the mind link that is inherent in this technology. And so what we've got to do if we're going to not lose this race is develop that aspect of ourselves. And it's so dangerous because, remember, at the turn of the 20th century, the single greatest power on the planet was the British Navy.
That's true.
And so where's the British Navy today?
Yeah,
they're
exactly.
They're totally irrelevant.
Exactly.
Because of technology. And with the development of the present development, the alarming rate of development of these technologies, it can transform the balance of power on our planet in the blink of an eye.
Yep, overnight.
Yes. And that's the greatest fear, I think, that our government has right now in terms of a terrorist threat. That if a terrorist faction or cell group gets a hold of this kind of technology, it's just unfathomable, really, what they'd be able to do with it.
Well, let me tell you, Pentagon right now as we speak, they are totally baffled over what might have been used in Iraq in March to take out an Abrams tank. They said that it's got you can barely put your finger through the hole of what went through it, and then a bigger hole went out of it, and they have no idea what it was.
Wow.
You know, it was not conventional weaponry that did it. It was used in Iraq, and I'm beginning to say, you know, did they have something from the Russians or the Chinese that they were experimenting with? They only used it once. It only took out one tank, and then it was never used again. Or was it perhaps those countries on their own? Maybe they were already there doing some testing, and they figured, hey, let's see if this thing works. And apparently, you can be a long, long way away to see if this thing works. But William, they have no idea what it is. It was a major story in Army Times, which, of course, is an official Army publication.
Wow, and I'm very surprised that even came out.
Exactly. exactly. I read that in Army Times, and I went, this isn't normal for them to release a story like that, that they have no idea what it was. And I'm beginning to think, was it laser technology or even some kind of plasma gun? So when you talk about having the upper edge in technology, somebody's been playing with something.
Right, and it's been my contention, going back to my book, The Atomic Christ, which was about FDR's search for the secrets of the Holy Grail in Mongolia, that that region of the world, including the Middle East, including Afghanistan, including China, Mongolia, was an enormous repository for the secrets of the ancient gods. Call them the Illuminati, call them extraterrestrials. There's all kinds of legends and rumors about subterranean civilizations there that are thousands of years in advance of our own technology. And when you follow the myths and legends of these civilizations, as I have, you're just absolutely compelled, and at the same time just simply blown away when you realize the extent to which they match modern science. It's, again, this notion that we're rediscovering this technology that may have existed in an incredibly advanced pre-flood world, and the secrets of this pre-flood civilization and technology are scattered throughout the planet. There's not just a single hall of records in Egypt. There's halls of records all over the planet.
I kind of look at you as, you're not an archaeologist, of course, you're an investigative mythologist, but I kind of look at you as an Indiana Jones type, where you go to all these different places to try to unravel these events, supernatural events, looking for the truth. Do you continue to look for new projects? How do they come your way?
Well, it's just following the muse, so to speak. As in this instance, the Cloak book, Cloak of the Illuminati, came up because I was finding these incredible examples of this cloak that had been passed along throughout history, and that naturally led to the Oracle of the Illuminati book, the transformation undergone once one wears the cloak. So they just kind of naturally evolve, but as I mentioned earlier, the centerpiece of all of my books and research is this pillar or antenna that was brought here by the gods and is used as not only a communications device, but also has tremendous applications in terms of weapon systems and also personal spiritual applications as well. It's the unified technology of the gods.
Which you believe could be in Iraq.
Which most certainly is in the records of Iraq and could well exist in the physical domain in Iraq as well.
90 to 100 feet, 180 feet.
Yes, having a telescopic ability, yes.
Buried or hidden away?
Probably in one of the subterranean facilities that we read about. I have pointed to the marshland in southern Iraq
uh-huh.
as a possibility, but again, I mean, we did such a good job of scattering all the artifacts from the National Museum there in Baghdad that, the pieces of this puzzle are shattered like a great mirror. And researchers such as myself and others, we have just a tiny fingernail's worth of evidence that we're operating from. There's thousands upon thousands of tablets that we haven't had access to yet that I'm convinced actually point to the real technology behind what we're describing here.
What do you think it's made with, William?
Well, they called it the Palladium Pillar in Rome. It actually had been transported there from Troy in the early 300s, and this pillar was used by the Vestal Virgins in Rome, and it was actually, when you look at the stories, it suggests that it's a device that held the soul of a savior figure. And so when you look at it from the perspective that it's called palladium, and then you go and research palladium itself as an element, it's a gold alloy, you follow that trail and you find out that the Egyptians said that this pillar was lined with gold. And I asked the question, is it possible that we're talking about either gold or a gold alloy such as palladium? In that case, it would have been made from that element.
Oh, my gosh, to have that, and it's thousands and thousands of years old for that kind of technology, and even though it may have been handed down, let me ask you this. You know, we talked about what might have been on the Ark of the Covenant. Do you believe that this is what was on the Ark of the Covenant, or is this a separate object?
No, I'm convinced that there's the complete Ark of the Covenant has the base platform that we think of as the traditional Ark, the golden box.
Right.
And the description that's given in the Bible is actually, I believe, a miniature form of this larger device. And on top of that platform, and this device is featured in my books, and Dana Augustine has done a phenomenal job of bringing this to life.
Yes.
Attached to that platform is this pillar. And I was just really excited. I went to New York this summer and spent a day at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And lo and behold, I didn't know it at the time, they actually have a fresco that's 44 inches tall and about the same dimension wide in the Metropolitan Museum of Art that features this pillar in operation. It had been taken out of the Temple of Abydos in Egypt and brought to New York. And it hangs there, and it just kind of sits there in a corner, and people don't pay a whole lot of attention to it. But what you see is this incredible device that's being operated by these priests, and it's the goddess Isis that stands beside it. They call it the pillar or symbol of Osiris. And it's the device that we're describing here that the Egyptians said could drill holes in space. It looks like an antenna because that's what they said it also could do. It attracted the energy that fed the gods.
You don't think some rich person has purchased it as a collection item or somewhere in somebody's house?
Well, that's the fear. It's a fact that the books, the tablets, the pieces of ancient art come upon the private art world, and they disappear into these private collections. And from time to time in my quest, I've been invited to go see some of these private collections. One of them is the Morgan Library in New York. That's founded by J.P. Morgan, who is, of course, one of the Illuminati figures we're talking about, mm-hmm. the enemy of Nikola Tesla, who hoarded a lot of these types of art that we're describing here, and you just don't see it. It's as if they know the value of it and have taken it into their personal possession, and they keep it off the open market.
Well, as you said, that it is possibly a time machine type object. They've probably gone into the future, knew what kind of stocks to buy, came back into whatever era they were living with, and made millions. That's why they got their money.
Theoretically possible, but I have to say this too, that this technology is a double-edged sword, and we have to remember that at the center of Atlantis was supposed to have been a power source that is called the Pillar of Mero, which is what we're describing here, and it was because of their misuse of this technology that led to the downfall of the Atlantean civilization, according to various sources.
What's your next appearance, physical appearance? Where are you going next?
I am going to, and I'm very honored to be going there as well, to Dr. Chet Snow's Signs of Destiny 2 conference in Tempe, Arizona, his Crop Circle conference. I'll be seeing my good friend Lawrence Gardner there and being able to confer with the Crop Circle experts on this research we've been describing tonight.
I think Linda Bolton Howe will be out there too, won't she?
Linda will be there. It'll be a great opportunity to meet her for the first time. Spoken with her on the phone, but never met face-to-face. And I love these events. I had been at the Bay Area UFO Expo in Santa Clara and had a nice chat with Richard Hoagland while there, John Anthony West. These guys are, I idolize these.
Well, you're all giants in the field. I have heard that the Denver airport is very strange. Have you heard that?
Oh, it's utterly bizarre. Yeah, I've been flying in and out of there since 96 when it first opened, and dedicated to the New World Order, all kinds of just actually perverted artwork throughout it, Masonic symbolism, Illuminati symbolism etched into the marble tiling of the place, rumors of subterranean facilities attached to it, all kinds of, it's kind of a spooky place.
What do you think the purpose of that was?
Well, when I first started going out there, the stated purpose was that the anticipation of some form of a cataclysm, and that the Denver area encompassing the vicinity of NORAD and Colorado Springs, just a couple hours south, would be the center hub for the New World Order. And so it kind of goes from there. I don't have any, I can't point to any evidence that says that that's what the actual case is, but that's what I've been told by people out there that have researched the story.
Yeah, we've got to unravel that one. Let's go for some calls. You ready?
Absolutely.
West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with William Henry. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
We're doing great.
I was wondering if you guys had heard something about crop circles. Well, no, not crop circles. They're like weeds or plants growing in a circle about a foot in diameter, and usually there's like rocks in the middle of them start coming up, and they're usually really cold, and the ones around the outside are hot. And they kind of stay that way.
Where have you heard about this? And
no, I've seen them.
Whereabouts?
Richmond, California, and some in San Francisco.
Strange.
Certain places
not
that
like,
I seem to gravitate towards.
And all right, not like traditional crop formations.
Oh, no, this is like randomly. Like all the weeds, like, will start to come up, and they don't. They start maybe an inch or so, and then they die off. All the rest just grow nice and tall and green, and they're in the perfect circle or spiral, usually circles.
William, sounds like another Linda Moulton Howe investigation.
Yeah, absolutely does. Sounds like you got a little mini vortex going there.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, have you heard anything about San Francisco having anything, you know, significant with, like, these pillars or anything like that? Because the Indians that used to live here used to say we'd be crazy to live here because this is where the four winds meet.
Interesting.
No.
These two places, we can't take pictures, and I can't even be there. It throws me off. It's very, very strong.
All right, that is
by Land's End.
William, most of your investigations, your investigative mythology, is based in these older countries, these European nations, the Middle East, as opposed to mythology in the United States. Is that correct?
Well, surprisingly, that was the case up until about 1999 or 2000 when I started paying closer attention to the ancient history of America. I mean, there's a whole prehistory in this country that many of us, we grow up not knowing a thing about. And unless you happen to be living in, for example, Mount Ida, Arkansas area, or you're living in certain areas in the Rockies or California, even the Malibu area has got all kinds of legends about what's going on in that area. Unless you live in one of those areas, you're just not going to develop a familiarity with it. But once you pull on the string and start comparing the myths and legends of ancient America, you're surprised to find how closely they match the stories of the ancient world and the Middle East, for example.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. Your turn. Hi there.
Yeah, how are you?
Good, sir.
Good. Now, I'd like to ask your guest, because I'm Alan up in Newington, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
I call him periodically. But, Mr. Henry, I understand the Illuminati, the Trilateral Commission, and the Council on Foreign Relations, and George Bush are all of one thing. Is that possible?
I suppose it's possible that it's a little bit outside of the research that I specialize in.
And I tell you what, William, let's hold off on that question. And, Alan, if you will call tomorrow, because my guest is David Icke, and one of the things he'll be talking about will be conspiracies. So that question might be a little more right up his alley instead of William's. His more of mythology. But just to chat again about the Illuminati in general, we're not talking about a lot of people, William, are we?
Probably not. It would number, I would surmise, in the modern era into just several thousands.
Yeah, not a lot at all. Let's go to our first-time caller line. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hey.
Hey.
William?
Yes.
Hey guys. I'm pretty new to all this, and my question was had to do with the Saddam Hussein, the stone and the whole Stargate. What I wanted to know is, does it mean that physical limitations of living do not apply to Saddam? Because you said that theoretically it would be possible for him to be at Mars.
Right. That is, and I said that with a chuckle, but that's something that if you follow the trail of this research, that's where you're going to be led to. And yes, according to the myths and legends attached to this blue stone that Saddam is reported to possess, it has the ability to enable a human to transcend ordinary human physical limits. and gives them what we would equate the spiritual power of the gods, able to manipulate matter, to bilocate, be in two places at once, to communicate with the deity, in this case likely the Anunnaki, who aren't deities at all, but they're gods with the little g, in abilities such as that.
And, of course, it wasn't too much tongue-in-cheek. I'm holding up my morning edition of the New York Times, where it headlines, William Henry says that Saddam's on Mars.
He's sure not in Iraq.
I'm kidding. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast, you're on the air with William Henry. Hi there.
Hi. Hello, George. Yeah. William. This is Ron calling from Arlington, Texas.
Welcome, Ron.
William, you have a beautiful website.
Thank you, sir, very much.
Okay, I have one simple question. At what age did you become fascinated with mythology?
I was probably 20 years old. When I was in college, I read the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which was an international bestseller at that time, 1982. And it introduced me to the notion of Christian Gnosticism, an alternate version of Christianity that describes the ability of the individual to directly communicate with God with a big G without the intervention of a priesthood.
Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. Any more questions?
No, I was just curious because looking at that website and those books, oh, yeah, I'm going to be buying some books.
Great.
And
you've got very much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
It helps support the research. That's how I do. I do this full time, and I'm very pleased to be able to do so and thankful that listeners such as those on Coast have supported the research.
How many books do you have out there now, Way?
This is my 10th book. Oracle of the Illuminati is book 10.
Good for you. Good for you. Do you find that the writings of the books takes a lot of research, or are you in the groove so much now that it's coming easier for you?
No, it's brutal. It's absolutely brutal work to go through because the learning curve, the bar only increases with each book. It's not
you keep pushing yourself, don't you?
Yeah, you keep pushing, and it's constantly engaging new material and trying to look at it in new ways, and it is it takes a lot of discipline. It takes a lot of focus and literal physical strength to do this kind of work, I think, because you're processing so much at all times.
Wildcard Line, your turn. Welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
George?
It is.
William?
Hi.
William, first of all, George, William is cute, but I want to tell you, George, you are definitely cuter.
No, yeah, I'm just different.
Uh-uh, honey, you're the star that could walk through my gate anytime.
Oh.
That's great.
Well, okay.
On a card.
Anyway, I had to tell him that.
I'm blushing, William.
Okay, I want to see that, too. I want to ask William about...
It's my old girlfriend calling, William. I'm kidding. No,
no,
go
I'm
ahead.
Not. No, it's not.
All right.
No, he didn't. It's true, he is cute. George, you'll see. I wanted to ask a question about, you said about the Stargate. We have to shed some ways like that we have today to get to that consciousness in the future. I just want to know specifically, like, what do we have to shed in our mental, spiritual, and physical to get to that level?
Well, the way I like to think of it is in terms of the seven chakras that line our spinal cord system. Traditionally, people are taught to live within the first three chakras and approximately the sexual region of the body and the solar plexus, which is all about survival, power, manipulation, and control. And see, this is the reason I feel that the pillar attachment to the ark was omitted in the biblical story, because if you're interested in creating a patriarchal system that's going to keep people under control of that patriarchy, you're not really going to be interested in educating them in the levels above the solar plexus, including the heart, the throat chakra, the power of our word, the power of our third eye, and the crown chakra, the power of the ignited or enlightened consciousness. So in order to make that Stargate connection, we're going to have to be able to live as fully functioning human beings, which means living all up and down the ladder of light, as that collection of chakras is called.
Oh, super.
Okay, thanks for the
Thank
call.
Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Bye, George.
All right, bye. You know, William, the work you've done, the investigations that you have done, do you sometimes get, like, secretive messages from people who say, William, investigate this? And does that ever show up at your doorstep or in the mailbox?
It does all the time.
Really?
At events and email, I get things such as that. People say you have to keep such and such confidential, and I do. No men in black suits, fortunately, but that kind of thing does go on. It's just the nature of the business, so to speak. These expos that I go to along with the other speakers, it's never a dull moment in terms of the amazing range of knowledge that is represented at these expos, and even, of course, throughout the Coast audience. I mean, it's truly phenomenal, the think tank that has created the thought field that we're creating right now around this material. So,
actually, William, by the way, I think you are cuter than me. The picture I've put up on the website is borrowed from some magazine, and I'm kidding, but you know what? You're a neat guy, too. And how long have we been talking
that.
Now? A couple of years at least, huh?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I remember my very first disastrous interview with you as I tried to understand some of the coast-to-coast jargon, and you were so patient with me to come back again the second time and hold my hand, and now we're clicking along.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure, yeah. George. Thank you. I think you're doing a phenomenal job, too.
Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're on with William Henry. Hi there.
Hey, guys.
Hi
Great
there.
Show tonight.
Where are you calling from?
Albuquerque.
Wonderful. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, actually, one of my best friends used to work at DIA, Denver International Airport, and he worked and managed part of that baggage carousel area and things like that, and they said that occasionally all the baggage carousels and everything like that would basically shut down and completely not work. Nobody had an explanation for it, but I guess DIA was pretty used to it, and what they did was they actually brought in, I guess, some Native Americans from the area, and they would kick everybody out, and they'd come in and do a little ceremony and things like that, and all the baggage stuff would turn back on. And
you got to be kidding me.
Not at all.
Because I remember stories of they delayed the opening of the airport because the baggage carousels did not work. They had this brand-new computer system, and that's the first time I've ever heard that they brought in some spiritual help to get things going.
They say it occasionally happens, and that's what they do to counteract it.
Man, what is this built over? Do you know?
There's some claims. I mean, everybody says their home's built over an Indian graveyard or something like that. But I guess something about the area, they say that that's something similar to that.
That's a great story. We've got to do a program on that Denver airport out there.
Yeah, that's a good one. Ask David Icke about it. I think he's written about it in the past.
Has he? Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. The Denver airport. I'll do that tomorrow night. He is on. Let's go. If we have time. Of course we do. Wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on with William Henry. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, William.
Yeah.
I'm calling from Rockland, California. My question is, earlier on in the program, very early on in the program when you came on, William, George had asked you, or had told you that, you know, several times, the listeners had participated in collective consciousness and had put their minds or prayer or whatever you want to call it to certain events, such as the rains in Los Angeles for the fires, which you got to admit, it's pretty rare that it would rain all of a sudden after three-digit weather in the past month. So what I wanted to ask you is, do you believe that if, and there are several evil people out there, and trust me, there are, if a lot of evil people got together and did the same thing, which the coast people seem to practice in, and wanted something ill against a person or an event, would they be just as successful? And I'll hang up and take my answer on the air. And thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Can evil collectively do what we try to do on a positive basis, William?
Yeah, I'm convinced that they can, and this is... some people are kind of alarmed by that statement, but inherently the techniques whereby these phenomena are created are neutral. And I mean, I used to have to answer this question when I was talking about FDR's search for the Grail and his race against Adolf Hitler to find those secrets. They would say, how can an egomaniac like FDR and an evil person such as Hitler actually find the most sacred artifact in all of human history, by some accounts? And the answer is that it's all neutral. And that's kind of an unfortunate aspect of it, but that, I feel, is just the way it is.
Well, indeed, too. Now, let's talk a little bit again about the availability of the new book, Oracle of the Illuminati. You can get it off your website, right?
Yes, which is williamhenry.net, or they can call 615-292-7863. The price of the book is $24.95, and if you pre-order, it ships on December 1st. But if you pre-order here in November, shipping is free.
I'll tell you, it's a great book, and it's got some great graphics to it. Server might be a little slow. I may have gotten you again tonight, William.
Oh, no.
You're getting hit with a lots and lots of people. Of course, you always do, don't you?
Every time. You just you try to do your best to be ready.
Well, you're ready, but... have patience, people. Get through. He's got a great website, as you heard from the caller just a few calls ago. William, I have this fast blast in from Kathy in Colorado, and it says, I've got a friend who knows a United Airlines pilot that was stopped at gunpoint, she says, by a Marine when he went down four floors below at the Denver International Airport before it opened, and was told that if he was seen down there again, he may be forced to shoot. Isn't that something?
That's incredible.
What is down there?
Mm.
I have to go on a little mission. You go first, though. Ready for some more calls?
Absolutely.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast with William Henry. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing, George? Hey, William.
Hi.
Hey, you spoke of a few elements tonight, and I'm going to tie them together for you. You're looking for the Ark of the Covenant, right?
Absolutely.
A pillar that could do time travel.
Mm-hmm.
A sapphire stone that had power. And... I'm a little nervous, but I'm trying to get through it here.
You had a great
another
job.
One there. Oh, how to maybe the possibility to make a Christ-like being, right?
Or the yeah. Stargate. Maybe the Stargate.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I'm kind of like you, William. I'm kind of like a detective, and a few pieces snap together. And, George, I'm just going to tell you a few things here. I'm not going to read the Bible or nothing, but there's use it as an artifact text. William, go back to Ezekiel 11, where he said that there was four faces on those beings that were there. The four faces were an ox, an eagle, a lion, and a human face.
Mm-hmm.
And in Ezekiel 27, they said about the sapphire stone. You go back and look it up when you get a chance, but there's a sapphire stone mentioned in Ezekiel 27. Okay?
Okay.
With these beings that were approached. Now, a year ago or so, I was watching Discovery Channel, and they were looking for the Ark of the Covenant. And it took him to Scotland into a church that nobody goes to. That's whatever. But there's these pillars in this church.
Roslyn Chapel, would that be?
I'm not sure of the name.
Okay.
But here's the deal. Up the top of the pillars have these four faces, the ox, the eagle, the human, and the lion.
Hmm.
And the pillars are shaped in this weird shape. And no one ever stood what it was. But when I saw it on TV, it almost put me on the floor. It looks like DNA strands.
Right. Yeah, I believe that you're describing the pillars at Roslyn Chapel in Scotland, which is a phenomenal place. It's a literal Holy Grail repository, a book in stone. And I think if you look up Roslyn Chapel, you're going to find that that's what you're describing.
It could be. But if that's some kind of perfect formula for perfect DNA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that Roslyn Chapel, I went there several years ago to take a look at it. And the reason I went there is because in the very center of that chapel is a arrow that's pointing down at the center of the floor there. And a legend that's attached to it says that if you understand the secrets here, you know enough. And researchers have said that the lost scrolls of the Nazarene are believed to be hidden underneath the floor there, and they want to tear up the floor and retrieve the scrolls. Well, What's at the end of that arrow is a cluster of grapes, which symbolizes the blue stones. And it's my view that if you know enough about the blue stones, you know enough.
Well, that's perfect, then.
Great. Thanks for your call, Dave.
Hey, thank you.
Appreciate you being part of the program. These blue stones, if they are sapphires, and they could be, right?
Possibly.
I mean, could you, like, are you talking about a sapphire that you would purchase at a jewelry store that would have the same kind of power?
I don't think that, so, that that would be exactly what we're talking about. I mean, it's part of the equation because, as I mentioned earlier, what the sapphire is supposed to provide for us is the holy blood, which is the Holy Grail.
Okay. So, there's more symbolism there than just a traditional gemstone.
Precisely. It's a symbol, it's a trigger that's to lead you someplace else.
All right, east of the Rockies, your turn. Welcome to the program. Hi.
Hi, this is Janine.
Hi, Janine. Go ahead.
Hi. By the way, you are very good looking, George.
Oh, thanks, Janine.
You're welcome. First, I want to talk. Hi, William.
Hi.
I've read a lot of your books.
I called you
one or two times about, you know, some of your products. Great, fantastic, wonderful. I did have a meditation years ago on my origin, and it showed me I was a blue spark. And the blue spark, that every human being has a blue spark in their body, which, you know, when the big blast occurred, the sparks came off the big blast, and each of us humans have the blue spark, and it's in your heart. And if you meditate and you put a Star of David over your body and you meditate on the blue star, it will go up through your crown and take you out into the universe, and you can travel to different planets. And I've done that. And since we're coming into the concordance, you know, to the harmonic concordance, that would be something that people could do, is, you know, meditate on that blue spark, that blue pearl in their body. Plus, I wanted to talk to you about the UT, a sound. It's called a UT sound. Have you ever heard of that?
No, UT sound?
Dr. David Pulse is doing workshops now with tuning forks, and he came up with it's based on 3, 6, and 9. You know, and Tesla said if you can discover the secrets of 3, 6, and 9, you'll discover the secrets of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And this scale is a Salvaggio scale. It used to be the Catholic Church took it away because they wanted to control masses. And it was do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, and they took do, re, and put, ute was there originally in the place of do. And T was gone, so it was a sixth scale, so that goes with the Star of David also, the tones. And these are all tones that are scaled 2, 3, 6, and 9. And they're just amazing. That's vibrational tones, and I just took the workshop, and it's like instant feeling of the vibration that, you know, of healing. So you might want to check on that UT.
Okay, I'll do that. Thank you very much.
396 hertz.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I had a dream last night of the Dalai Lama, and he had a blue stone on his finger. You know, so there's something with that blue stone.
There is.
Gene, it'd be great if you could send an email on that meditation. I'll put it right up on my site along with Dana's graphic about the star tetrahedron. Because
I had a computer fire. Took my computer, so I used to email you, but I can't email you anymore.
Ate it up until you get another computer, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Janine.
Okay, bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Tones seem to resonate throughout history as well. A guest last night, again, Hank Wesselman, had a CD, and it had to do with getting you into a spiritual state for projection and time travel through your mind. Had to do with special tones that you hear with drums and rattles.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to all click.
Absolutely, yeah. There's without a doubt, a duplicatable technology that's been passed along throughout history that's inherently very simple. And once we get the right combination of tones, clicks, rattles, we're off and running.
I'm going to ask you something that's a little off the path here. Every night for the last month and a half, I've been getting a fast blast from the same guy, William, who wants me to ask every guest if we've been to the moon. I'm going to ask you and be done with him. Have we been to the moon, William?
I don't know.
Okay, that's all I need. I just need that from you as an answer to satisfy this 80-day barrage I've been getting from one person. Mm. Wildcard Line, welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, hi, this is Scott calling out of Peoria, Illinois.
Hi, Scott.
On 1470.
Yes, sir.
How's it going tonight, George?
We're doing well. Thanks for the ask.
I just wanted to call and ask your guests about, I'm a firm believer in the old Hopi prophecy of the purification. And recently, another frequent guest that's been on your show a lot, Sean David Morton, has posted on his internet site that the harmonic concordances also marks the beginning of the purification. And I was wondering what your guests might think about that.
That's a possibility. That's what I was talking or getting to when we were talking about the solar flares. My brother-in-law, Donnie Hinkle, calls them Holy Grail, Holy Flares. Because that's what we might be describing here. And the purification is not necessarily a wiping out of humankind. Rather, it is an enlightening of humankind through cosmic rays emanating likely from the center of our Milky Way galaxy.
And you believe this could be 11-11?
I don't. It could be the start of it. I don't think that this weekend is going to... It portends this great enlightenment that... so many prophets have described, but I certainly think it could be an opening of the doorway towards that.
And do you believe that it's also stands as like maybe like man's last hope changes ways before the end times?
I'm not one of those that really subscribes to the gloom and doom aspect of it. I think that there's always a way to change it, that we can begin to divert our consciousness into a way such that something along those lines doesn't have to happen in that way, and I don't think it's too late.
Okay.
Not at all.
The reason I ask is there's one thing that's really drawn me to it is a local band named Anger Wound that's really believers in the purification, and they, too, have predicted 11-11 to be the start of it. And, like, here recently, it's just all worked out right to the right date. And it's just, I don't believe in coincidence either, George.
No, they're on. How about you, William? Do you believe in coincidence?
No, I mean, that's the whole premise here is that there is an unseen hand that's operating and guiding in our lives, and the object is to make a connection with that so that we live in a constant state of synchronicity or coincidence in the right place, right time, right people, right action, right words.
Hmm.
If we can live in that way, we're going to be just fine.
The moment.
Right.
First time caller line. Hello, you're on with William Henry. Hi there.
Hi, hello.
Oh, hello.
How are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
I'll get right to my question and take the answer off the air. You were talking about the Ark of the Covenant earlier, and I heard you guys were talking about Scotland. But actually, I've done a little research in the past because it's always been something that kind of interested me. But as far as the theory that it's kept in Axum, Ethiopia, and I'm trying to remember the name of the cathedral. I thought it was like St. Mary's Cathedral in Axum, but I didn't know if your guests could elaborate on that at all, if you'd heard anything about that. But supposedly, I guess, there's like a person who guards it, and then when the person actually passes away, they have the priest at the church actually watch the Ark of the Covenant for a short time until they get another guard, and then that's what the person does for the duration of their life.
Right. You're describing the research of Graham Hancock in his book, The Sign and the Seal. He followed that search, and he was led to that sanctuary in Ethiopia where it's claimed that the Ark rests today. There's probably more than one copy of the Ark of the Covenant, and it's possible that there is something that is there. I haven't been there personally, don't have first-hand knowledge of that, but it's quite possible.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Appreciate your phone call. Clock's going to tick on us, William. Let's get as many calls as we can. A lot of people have been on hold for you, I'm sure,
Great. For
a very long time. Wildcard line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi there.
Yeah.
This is Donald calling from Corvallis, Oregon.
Hi,
and,
Donald.
Just want to say hello and ask William to elaborate a little bit more on the mythology around Mount Ida, Arkansas.
Are you familiar with that? Tell us a little bit about that first, if you would.
Well, the story is that when the original gods came down, they were called the Saba gods. And this name Saba is, for example, the root of the Queen of Sheba, and appears in numerous instances, including Egyptian mythology. And the story is that they deposited all of the sacred knowledge into quartz crystal at a place called Mount Ida. Ida being the root for our word idea. And people have looked around and said Ida is in Crete, it's in Turkey, it's in all of these other places. But the fact of the matter is that there's only one Mount Ida on the planet that has pure quartz crystal. And that's Mount Ida, Arkansas. And it's been my supposition that perhaps the Ida of myth was actually here in America. Now, the interesting thing about this is that Ida was called the Glass Mountain, glass being a reference to the crystal. And it's fascinating that the Great Pyramid in Egypt, as wondrous as it is a copy, a derivative of the original Glass Mountain. It's a duplicate of something else. And it could well be that this sacred repository of knowledge that we're looking for is not underneath the sands in Egypt. It's rather here in Arkansas.
Okay. Now, that is a fascinating speculation, that actually something is over on this side, huh?
Exactly, and then it was all exported to present-day Egypt.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast for a quick question. Go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Ted from California.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to make a relation between Art's show on Sunday night and what you're talking about tonight, in which John Lear mentioned that the aliens or the people watching us from beyond consider us just empty, you know, vessels, containers, and that they basically want our cerebrum, our cortex, our thinking process, in which we are the only people capable of transcending physical reality, and such as astral projection or going beyond, like that woman spoke earlier about going to different planets and stuff, in which we can do that by just meditating and going. And we can take our spirit separate from our physical body and go anywhere we want. Time is irrelevant. There is no time. Go back and forth and look at it all. And it's all actually quite irrelevant, all of this.
I think we can absolutely travel that way. I'll let you get your response off the radio, if you would, William, very quickly.
Yeah, going back, I think what they're describing there in terms of what is inside our container or this manufacturing plant or resurrection machine that is the human body is that blue spark, the divine spark, the blue pearl, the blue stone, the blue apple, as it's called. And it's the ignition or the alighting of that blue spark within us that enables us to have these phenomenal abilities.
The book is called Oracle of the Illuminati. William Henry, his website, williamhenry.net. If you're already on coasttocoastam.com, you can very easily link up to that, and it'll be up there sometime throughout tomorrow as well. Always a gracious guest, William Henry. William, next time, thanks again.
Thank you, George, and many blessings to everybody this weekend.
Absolutely. Don't forget his conference. Get the information on his website. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, webmaster Lex Lonehood, Barbara Simpson, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next program with guest controversial David Icke. Until then, be safe, everyone.